Hello, I'm Başak Etkin.
Hi, I'm Kostya Gorobets. Welcome to Borderline Jurisprudence.
Now, we really didn't mean for this season to be so focused on the history of international law, but we have yet another historian. Today, in our Early Career Scholar episode, we are focusing on the intellectual history of international law with an emphasis on Jus Gentium and how its conceptualizations came to give birth to the idea of customary international law. Dr. Francesca Iurlaro, Alexander von Humboldt postdoctoral fellow at Max Planck Institute for Comparative Public Law and International Law in Heidelberg, joins us for this conversation. Francesca, welcome.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure.
Pleasure to have you, Francesca. And as Başak already said, your scholarship rotates around the historiography and intellectual history of international law with a focus on Jus Gentium. So what fascinates you about the subdiscipline of international law, and how did you come to write your upcoming book, The Invention of Custom, Natural Law, and the Law of Nations, circa 1550-1750?
So thank you so much for the invitation today and for giving me the chance to talk about my work a bit. So I guess what brought me to the invention of custom was not a linear path at all. I actually studied philosophy. But in Italy, there's actually this still this very strong historical tradition. So analytical philosophy is almost non-existent, at least where I studied. So, and this is because there's this big tradition of historicism that is still so entrenched in the school and university curricula. So basically, I ended up studying history of philosophy just because it seemed to me the best thing I could do, and also because I've always been a Latin and ancient Greek geek, so it seemed a very convenient thing to do for me. And I really loved, and I still benefit from, the methodological rigor that it gave me. So basically, I think what I really learned with this type of background is to trying to come up with new theoretical insights by obsessing over textual minutiae, which is basically what I do to this day. But I think this very traditional background started to feel very limiting in terms of substance quite soon, because I think, so we kept on studying the usual suspects, so Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, Spinoza, and that was amazing. I really treasure all that training, but somehow I felt like I wanted to put all that knowledge and that training to a different type of use. And I think the revelation came to me when I stumbled upon Gentili after having read Carl Schmitt. But actually, I think when I read about Gentili and Schmitt, I had a bit of a sort of a Madeleine moment, because basically Gentili and I go way back. Because as a child, I actually used to live in San Ginesio, which is his birthplace. So the guy has been haunting me for as long as I've lived, basically. And my mom always tells me that basically we used to walk past his statue every morning as we went to school. But coming back to more recent events, I think when I read about Gentili, I was really fascinated by the complexity of the text. All these references, it was really striking for me that he was a lawyer, but he was using all these sources from poetry, philosophy, history. And this somehow also confirmed my intuition that I could put that classical knowledge to a different use. And the different use was international law. So I graduated with a thesis on Gentili, but then in the meantime, I also started attending classes on international law. And I actually even joined the Hague Academy one year, I think it was 2013, which was the year when James Crawford was giving his general course there. And I think that's also when I first learned about opinio iuris. And I think I was really fascinated by the whole, what came first, practice or the psychological elements of custom. And I think that probably was also what stimulated my philosophical mind. And I kept coming back to this idea, but I didn't really know what to do with it. Until then, I applied for an LLM at the UI, where I also did my PhD. And I remember meeting my ex-supervisor, Nihal Buddha, and I kept babbling about opinio iuris. So I remember he looked at me and said, well, it really looks like you're writing a book on the history of customary international law. So yeah, that's how it all started.
Yeah, so some listeners might not know that you are a historian by training, as as you just mentioned. So because, as Bashak said, this is this episode of our podcast, surprisingly, is all about history. How you as a historian think, what you think about this turn to history that is now so much profound in the discipline?
Thank you. It's a really nice question. I honestly think I'm one of those people who really benefited from the opening of the field, and I'm really grateful that that I have so many wonderful colleagues, and also there more and more plurality of voices talking about the history of international law, and I hope that this will continue instead of shrink into the future. But actually, so I have a specific take on this issue that I think comes from years of studying this, the Jus Gentium tradition. And so my focus is between the 16th and the 18th century. And I think the more I studied specific period, the more I don't find the idea of the turn to history so surprising. So I understand that for lawyers today, the very idea of incorporating history into their professional language is a big deal. And I understand that this also generates concerns for method, because of course you want to do it and you want to do it in a way that brings you good and meaningful legal insights. But I think you guys in the podcast mentioned the genealogical anxiety that seems to be so typical of international law. And I think based on what I've been working on in the past few years, I don't think that the genealogical anxiety is a phenomenon only impacts on contemporary international lawyer. And I think that it's been with international law ever since. So the authors that I studied, so studying from Gentili, but also Grotius and Pufendorf, so they don't really use history to soothe a genealogical anxiety. But because that was for them the only method that they had to generate new laws in lack of a central authority. So clearly history was for them a question of addressing the question of authority. Because of course, for them, the question was, what do you do when you have to apply laws where laws do not exist, that is to say between sovereigns? So they looked at history for inspiration and they really asked a very simple question, like how did people do things in the past? What led some nations to success and others to failure? So in this sense, I want to be a bit radical here when I say that maybe there has never been a turn to history, because international law was always a historical discipline. Of course, things changed in the 19th century because the so-called because of the so-called professionalization of international law. But let's focus on what happens before then. And I think that another important issue to raise is what we mean by history when we talk about the turn to history. So I think when we read Gentili and Grotius, basically what they were doing was what we do with the whole founding fathers mythology. So they basically turned to their own myths, so authors that they perceived as important, such as Livy or Virgil or Cicero. But for them, the very idea of history was way more all-encompassing than it is for us, because it included all forms of written testimonies from the past, so including not just historiography, but also poetry, philosophy, biblical texts, and so on and so forth. So I think in this sense, and I really have this very strong textual approach in my research, and from this perspective, I agree with scholars like Christopher Warren that it is crucial to include the literary in this in historical turn, if you really want to talk about a turn. Although I honestly would be in favor of dismissing the idea, because as I said, once it is historicized, it loses significance. That's basically what international lawyers have always been doing. They basically wrote about international law by writing history. And in the book, as well also in under articles, I have, for example, an article coming up with the Leiden Journal of International Law, where I talk specifically about this. I claim that Gentili and Grotius were not just literary erudites. So they were not just using historical and poetic references to craft their own international legal arguments, but they professionalized the use of such sources in a way that it became constitutive of Jus Gentium as a discipline. So again, to put it radically, Jus Gentium is literature, Jus Gentium is history. This is the way that these people were writing about this stuff. They were interpreting text from the past, basically as literary historians would do today. So they would obsess about finding old manuscripts. They would talk about them with colleagues, writing them letters. They would correct textual interpretation with the hope of making them better, advancing new ones. And they were doing all this with a very unapologetic, manipulative attitude. So in the sense, for me, Jus Gentium really is the discourse built around the challenging and also the manipulating and sometimes authoritatively defending the interpretation of this text, even when they're partly based on fake stories or on inauthentic texts. So I have a lot of examples of this in the book. So I think, as I said elsewhere, my whole approach to the historical turn in international law is basically to interpret international law as intertextual law, because I see this connection between text, between in different times and spaces, particularly compelling and constitutive of the discipline.
That was an amazing answer. But there is an elephant in the room, and we need to get this elephant out of the way. Why invention of custom? Because I believe to many, this expression will sound quite provocative, since they would say that customs are not invented, but discovered, as the official story goes. So in a way, this also assumes that we have always lived with custom as the most basic form of normativity. Could you tell us a bit more about your narrative of invention?
Yes, of course. Well, I think this is pretty much a consequence of what I said above about my idea and my perception of the history of international law. So if we think of Jus Gentium as a historical discipline, as a literary practice, as a rhetorical practice, I think the word invention makes sense. So it doesn't mean to make up arguments, but to find them. So in Latin, the word invention really comes from the verb invenio, which means to find. So, and as I said, one way to find these arguments is to go find them in old text, which is what people like Gentili and Grotius do. And this is the narrative I try to sketch in the book. So of course, it's one of the many possible ones. I'm not saying that it's just about text, although we'll come back to the question of practice later on, but there are many, many entry points to this question. But this is what I found particularly interesting, because I think it helped me address the question of the normative value of custom and how it was developed through natural law. So the way I do this in the book, this idea of like finding arguments and finding custom is through an approach called history of historiography, which sounds a bit repetitive, but it's basically a subfield of history that retraces the development over time of different theories about the writing and the reading of history. So the reason why I think this is important is that the process of finding those arguments, so the process of finding what are the customs of international law, is as important as finding those customs. What do I mean by that? So this process can be really, really tricky because of course, if you think that customs are to be found, then somehow maybe you have already an idea of what are the customs that you want to find. So how do you approach text then? So do you approach text and authors from the past with your own idea of what a custom is, or do you let text speak to you? So of course, like as in our contemporary academic practice, we would try to be critical in analyzing the text, but I think there is still some continuity, I think, between what we do and what they used to do, because even when we select our academic literature as scholars, we still do it based on our bias and on the epistemic community that we belong to. But we still try to be aware of those biases, and we never, or at least we try not to bend the sources to let them say what we want them to say. Instead, people like Gentili and Grotius were just following their own agenda, and very unapologetically so. And this is an activity that Marty Koskenyami in his last book has called bricolage. So let me just give you an example too, so that maybe this is a bit clearer. So for example, Grotius, like others before and after him, was convinced that poisoning enemies was prohibited by a custom under the law of nations. So see, he already has a starting point. The normative importance of the custom is somehow acknowledged a priori. It's just a matter of proving it. And how does he do it? So he proves it by comparing two different Roman historians, Livy and Vegetius. But then quite abruptly, he dismisses Vegetius because he thinks he's unauthoritative. Why? We don't know. We only know that Livy is basically his most quoted author, and that it is often to Livy that Grotius turns to when he wants to find answers to his legal questions. So I guess to answer your question, I think the idea to frame the question of custom and the origins of customary international law as a narrative of invention is because it really helped me address this question of authority. But also because I think one really important part of this process here is that the mechanism of producing authority and the mechanism of knowledge production that were involved in such process are as important as the outcome, as I said before. So, because clearly to produce customs with this type of, in this type of framework, you really needed to be a humanist. So you need to be trained in all the values, but also in all the classical scholarship that Europe had produced. And somehow also these values and theories of custom were not only generated by these normative values that were present in classical scholarship, but they were also generated by this this process of engagement with text. And so I think, and this is also something I recently wrote about, and I think somehow also connected with the question of the history of international law and what it means for us today. I think from my perspective, it is interesting and crucial to acknowledge this idea of bricolage, because it clearly seems to be the ultimate and a very foundational argumentative structure of international law. But at the same time, I think sometimes I'm a bit perplexed because I understand that going through the process of untangling all the different ways and discourses and debates that these people were engaging with seems a bit too erudite. But as I said, it is the process is part of the outcome. So sometimes a bit provocatively, and for example, in my review of Koskenyemi's chapter on Gentili, I ask, so why should we still bother telling all the stories if contemporary international lawyers are no longer persuaded by the cultural processes that produces them? So in that sense, I think my provocation would be, so if international law's language is so intimately related to historical imagination, then why doesn't it become a theory of history?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I'm really fascinated by this idea of history of historiography. It sounds very meta, even though I think meta is now almost like half prohibited word.
Yeah.
But going from history to jurisprudence, in the introduction to your upcoming book, you write, and I quote, "While contemporary lawyers think of positivism as opposed to natural law, I shall challenge this overly abrupt distinction and depict natural law and positive law as symbiotic forces in the creation of the language of custom." So without doubt, both legal positivism and natural law have had a role to play in shaping our concept of custom and customary law. But they still have quite drastically different views of its nature, normative character, and significance in the overall evolution of the legal domain. So how exactly do you challenge the jurisprudential opposition between these two schools of thoughts?
Well, so I think I mentioned before that what I offer in the book is more a history of the values, the normative values that informed customary international law, rather than a history of fact. But so this was not my initial assumptions. Actually, when I started, I thought that the best place to look for custom would be positive law. Because in my idea, I thought intuitively, you should look for custom where change is allowed rather than some in some place like natural law that seems quite static and seems to provide some, yes, normative framework, but then what do you do with it? But I had to learn at my own expenses that there was a very frustrating starting point, because all these authors I was looking at in the early modern period, especially in the 16th century, didn't really give me the answers I was looking for. So even, for example, Francisco Suarez, who's basically, I think, one of the most, I'm not really surprised that international lawyers today really like him, because he's one of the most modern in his way of thinking about custom. But even he, yes, he says that jus gentium and custom is somehow a form of positive law, but he didn't give any concrete example of what these customs were, other than the usual, yes, ambassadors shouldn't be killed, yes, prisoners shouldn't be killed, women shouldn't be killed, and so on and so forth. But then I realized that actually, and that's where the whole history of historiography thing came, because I realized that I was basically waiting for these authors to do something that wasn't available to them, which is infer normative values from shared widespread practices. And what was more common instead, at least until the late 17th century, was to bend practices according to normative standards. And for example, let me just give you an example. I think one really good starting point here is to think about the word consensus and the idea of consensus. So we think of it as basically a general agreement of wills, of political wills, of expression of wills on a specific custom. But actually, before the 17th century, consensus was understood in two ways. So either as an abstract consensus of religious and moral views, mostly Christian, of course, or as the consensus of the scholars of the past that I told you about earlier. So it was a fictional consensus of basically a virtual library of sources that all said the same thing about a custom and about the importance for a certain standards of behavior to become a legal standard. So in the sense, I think that the whole idea of positive law, for example, in the school of Salamanca, it was very striking to me, because the fact that, and they're all very vocal about this, the fact that a custom has a positive law origin doesn't mean it is changeable over time. Sometimes the idea of custom as positive law is just used as a genealogical argument to explain that it originated in human history rather than in natural law. So I think through these twists and turns, I think I really, this is where the argument of the book came out, that basically the old question that kept haunting me about what comes first, does practice comes first or the psychological element of customary international law? I think the answer, at least the historical answer to it that I found, is that in this old story, what comes first is definitely the normative. Practice and the idea of state practice is a later invention. And yes, I say invention because, again, it corresponds to a specific turn into the practice and theory of writing history. So in the book, I basically talk about, I identify Pufendorf as the main actor of this change. And what is so different here? So basically, there's starts to be a certain discontent with the role of classical history and the idea that they could play a pragmatic function in the present. So for example, what Pufendorf does, and Pufendorf, by the way, he was also a historian. He was writing history, like contemporary history. Pufendorf basically starts looking at events around him and starts to do what basically his predecessors couldn't do. So infer standards of behavior from practice. And this, as I said, this corresponds to a specific moment in time in the European tradition of writing history, where not only the authoritative value of classical history starts to lose traction, but the idea of writing about international law becomes more and more connected with looking at practice, looking at treaties, looking at collection of treaties, for example, to see what it is that states are actually doing, rather than evoking some very, very distant past from I don't know, ancient Greece or the Roman Empire. But as I said, this is, I want to insist on this because of course, this doesn't mean that that state practice as such didn't exist. It's just that the theorization of it, I claim, didn't exist until the late 16th century. But of course, this doesn't mean that there were not practices, but that they were not theorized as important in the process of invention, of inventing custom.
You mentioned in a previous answer your recent review of Martí Koskenniemi's To the Uttermost Parts of the Earth, Legal Imagination and International Power. So there was a series of reviews about the book at the European Journal of International Law, and you talk about misunderstandings and disenchanting of Gentili's work. Gentili, once again. At one point, you explained that according to Gentili, natural law is deeply rooted in divine revelation and it can be intuitively grasped by humans, and that Euscentium then is the secularized or historical proof of natural law's existence. Could you explain what this means? How does international law come to be the tangible proof of natural law?
Yes, of course. Thank you for this question. So I guess we're so eager to make people like Gentili and Grotius the fathers of secularized international law that sometimes even historical debates around these figures tend to underestimate that religion was a big deal for these people. So both of them were exiles because of that. As far as international law or Euscentium is concerned, of course they had a universalizing idea of Euscentium and they truly believed that it could work for humanity as a whole. But first of all, somehow there was always the unspoken assumption that it made sense in a certain Christian environment where revelation played a big role, and as natural reason did. So let me give you an example from Gentili to explain what I mean. So of course, Gentili says, as a human, you have all the resources in you to grasp natural law without revelation. So you don't have to be Christian to grasp natural law. So you can have a sense of it even without it. And actually, this is quite interesting because Gentili and also his brother Scipio, they were all involved in this big questions about the Ottomans. So how can this big anti-Ottoman literature that basically asked how can the Ottomans win wars if they were not Christians? How can they be as successful as the Romans, but they don't have revelation? Well, the question is solved by Gentili through an anthropological argument. And it's a very, very fortunate one that says that basically, even if you're not Christian, if you're human, you must have some idea of God, however vague or non-Christian that is. And this idea Gentili takes from Cicero's work on the nature of the gods, which is a very, very fascinating text. And basically, the idea is that, yes, if you're a human, you have an idea of God. And that makes you somehow capable of understanding natural law, even in the absence of revelation. And incidentally, I think, as I said, this is a very long-standing, unfortunate argument that somehow gets challenged only later in the 18th century, when, for example, the German jurist Christian Wolff delivers this famous speech in Halle, the famous discourse on the practical philosophy of the Chinese in 1721, where he basically says that, yes, so they don't have God, they don't have, they're clearly not Christian, but they have a good moral system, and also they're very excellent in the art of government. And everybody was really unhappy in Halle, especially the Pietist faction, because of course, like, this idea that you can have a moral and legal system, even in the absence, not of just of revelation, but also of a very European idea of God, means that everything can work. And if everything is relative, then there is no authority, and no authority is possible. And of course, the Prussians were not really, really happy about this idea. But going back to Gentili, so the idea of natural law can be grasped through human reason, but also through divine revelation. He conveys it with a lot of beautiful metaphors, such as the famous one that he has is like a play on obscurity. So he says that natural law is that thing that if you try to prove it, you only make it more obscure. And I think when I first read it, it's a very fascinating way to put it, but I wasn't really sure what that meant. But then I started taking it seriously, and actually, yes, if you think about, I don't know, it is prohibited to kill your parents, but then you're like, yeah, but why really? And then you're like, yes, because, you know, filial devotion, you have to be, you have to respect your parents, but then you're like, why? And then you start to think that some people have killed their parents. So it's all very complicated. The more you question it, the more you actually make it very confused. And when I first found this sentence, I was also so confused. So I talked about it with Diego Panizza, who was one of the Gentili leading scholars that I had the chance to meet before he died in 2014. And we would have weekly meetings to talk about Gentili. And I'm really, really grateful I had the chance to meet him. But basically, when I told him this, he told me, careful, young lady, you're trying to Wittgensteinize Gentili. And back then he made it sound like it was a very heretic thing to do, but I think it's a very good point. And I stick to it to this day, because of course you don't talk about that which is unknown. But if, like Gentili, you believe that somehow justice manifests itself in history, then you don't talk about natural law. But what you think that is, like, this divine enlightenment that you received within you through natural reason amounts to natural law, then you can look at human history for traces and manifestations and evidence of this, let's say, natural light of justice, as he calls it. And then you can build Ius Gentium accordingly. And how you do it, as I said before, you just go through a bunch of ancient texts and figure out your mind, or bend the text according to your own idea, which in Gentili was basically a very strong idea about the power and even the legal superiority of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, so since you mentioned Wittgenstein and Wittgensteinianizing of someone's works, I have a very philosophical question for you. So if we come back to your book, you offer a very peculiar view of what it means to historicize international law. So you portray historicizing not as a form of some geeky curiosity, or, as you beautifully put it, and I quote, a subgenre for lovers of intellectual escapism in search of a distraction from the many problems of the contemporary world. So rather, you picture historicizing as a project with far-reaching implications. So your book offers this view of historicizing as an attempt to create a narrative for international law that is in some way uniting and structuring. And this very much reminded me of Bernard Williams' idea that history is, among other things, a matter of hope, that we care about history because we want to make sure that hopeful and truthful stories can go on making sense, and that while they do, they will be told. And that ultimately the stories we need are the hopeful ones. So would you say that your story about the invention of custom is a hopeful one?
No. No, I mean, no, it's a really big question. Thank you. No, I don't think it's a hopeful one, but it's probably because I have a very specific take on hope and what open history and having history respond to our desire for hope means. So yes, I think you're right. Like this idea of historicizing international law and historicizing it as a historical discipline, it was an attempt to offer a narrative. I hope it's not too uniting and too structuring, because I think, as I said, it's one of the possible narratives out there. But I think it was very clear to me that it is uniting in the sense that it aims at breaking this very long-standing narrative of historicism. And I think that if that's true, and to some extent it is for me, although I'm still making up my mind about it. So if historicism is one of these narratives that are still very pervasive in our understanding of international law, I don't know, I'm not sure that there's anything hopeful about sticking to this narrative. But as I said, I have a very, very weird take on hope in general. So I think one that I would call of Mary disappointment. So there's this song that I really like from this artist, this musician called Andrew Bird. And the song is called The New St. Jude. And I'm not gonna sing because, of course, this is not.
Oh, please do.
No, I don't want to ruin our listeners' experience. But what the song says is that here's a mighty revelation. Everyone is a disappointment and everyone is just a failure. And ever since I gave up hope, I'm feeling so much better. So I think.
Uplifting.
So I think this doesn't mean that we have to be resigned to the apocalypse, although of course we live in very apocalyptic times, but that somehow deference towards the authority of history is part of the problem. First of all, because it enables the I think continuation of this narrative of progress, which is something that we should get rid of, I think. But also, I also realize that there's something very, very Italian about my take on this, in the sense that, of course, I'm quite lucky to come from a country where everything around you is history. But I think the attitude, the intellectual attitude of showing too much deference to it, basically produces a country where everything and everyone is stuck. And I don't want that in my scholarship. And I don't wish that for the world in general. So apart from the tragedy of being Italian, I think, as I said, the probably looking at history for hope is not a good idea. But what I think it is hopeful about history is that, for me at least, is just theory by other means. But then you would say, then why bother being a historian? Just be a philosopher. But no, for me, history is a very specific way of doing theory that engages multi-temporality and engages humans as a whole. Because of course it asks questions about the past, but and inevitably project them into the future, even and regardless of our attempts at restraining anachronism. So my hope is that after having said everything about the process of knowledge production of history being as important as the result and as the idea that come after the process, my hope is that either one day legal practitioners and international law practitioners take this historical turn more seriously and start integrating historiography, as I said, the practice and the theory of writing history into positivism. But this is I understand this is very wishful thinking, but I'm gonna say it anyway. Or that we just write more stories altogether and different ones. So I think this is a claim that has been made often also in debates on customary international law, that basically, for example, from Chimney, in one of his last article on custom, where basically he said that he claimed that archival practices are inherently European. So the practice of assembling and hoarding documentation is inherently European. And this doesn't mean, of course, that there are not historical traditions outside Europe. That's not what I mean, but that like giving all our hope to history, maybe we can challenge that idea. And also history is not the only way we have to write stories. We have poems, we have novels, we have movies, we have hearts. Like we have all a lot of other ways to write and to do storytelling in a way in which if the process of doing international law is really a process about legal imagination, then it would be, at least my hope would be, that we do it in a way that is rigorous, yes, but also unrestrained by this deference towards the past, and able to converse with the past in a more creative manner. I don't know, whenever people write a very good novel, they of course engage with Dostoevsky, but this doesn't mean that they try to rewrite Dostoevsky. They just create a new story. So yeah, that's my hope.
Would you then say that if there is hope, and maybe there is, it's just not in history?
Not in the specific idea of history as the ultimate authority and the ultimate tribunal to which we can submit all of our instances, I think, because that's a very 19th century historicist idea, and I don't think there's any value into that type of thinking.
No, I want to say that your answer reminded me very much of Kafka's famous aphorism, yeah, that there is hope, but not for us.
Yeah, well, considering how things are going, that's I wouldn't be too surprised. Yeah.
This brings us to the speed round, the same three questions we ask every guest. And to start off, what is it that drives you to do what you do, academically speaking?
So since it's not hope.
The ghost of Gentili, maybe?
Ghost of Gentili, yes. That we clarified at the very beginning. I think just I wanna air quotes, just curiosity, like pure intellectual curiosity. This doesn't mean that I cannot do anything else than being academic, and I think that's a very important message to share, because sometimes
definitely
academia can seem the only path for a lot of us, no? And it's not. It's one of the possible careers that we can have, but it's definitely one where you have the freedom to live and make a career out of being curious, and that's what really moves me. Hmm.
And maybe the ghost of Gentili will be an answer to this question too, but what is something you struggle with?
Oh, yes. So Gentili, of course. I struggle with, and I think we had this conversation on Twitter already, I really struggle with the specifics, and probably my all final rant on hope was coming from there. I struggle with the specific style of academic writing, which I find too restraining. I understand the logic behind it, because it has to be scientific, everything has to be traced and references and ideas. So I think it's a very good system, but I struggle with that, because I don't feel it represents the depth and the layers that I have in my own head. It's an overly simplified version of what I'm thinking. So yeah, that's also another thing I hope that I can manage to include the different type of writing styles.
So how would you like to write if there were no this restraint of the academic standards?
International legal poems.
No. I think I would write a novel about international law.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. I would read it.
Yeah, definitely. I would read that too. And obviously, last but not least, what is a book or an article that you suggest everyone reads?
Okay. So since I mentioned it earlier, and because this whole literary turn in the historical turn has been quite inspirational for me, I think Literature in the Law of Nations by Christopher Warren. It's such a great book, and it was very, very inspiring for my own work. So yeah, it was published by OUP in 2015, I think.
Amazing.
Awesome.
Francesca Iorlaro, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.